What is up, crime crew? Welcome to episode number 71 of Murder Unscripted, true crime podcast where we aim to show you the other side of crimes that we've all come to know so well. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, a 23-year true crime producer, and I'm here with the encyclopedia of useless true crime facts and other general misinformation, my bestie, Melissa Spivey.
Okay, those facts are super useful. I whip them out at parties, and then everyone thinks I'm weird and stays away from me, so it's a win-win.
Yeah, I hate to inform you, there are several reasons why people stay away from you, but I'm sure that's one of many.
I'm fine with that.
So we are in the final episode of our September block called The Case That Haunts Me, and we've spent the last 4 weeks covering some crimes that stuck with and haunted not only victims' families, but so many other people.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we covered some really intense cases. I talked about the case that actually haunted the legendary Joe Kenda, and that was the murder of Army Specialist Darlene Kreshak. And then you and I tag-teamed and covered the Austin Yogurt Shop murders, where those four beautiful young ladies were murdered. And in that case, I feel like even now, 20-plus-odd years later,
yeah,
it continues to haunt, like, the whole city of Austin.
Agreed.
And then last week, you covered the incredibly brutal case of the Luna murders that is still haunting me a week later.
That's all. That was tough to get through. That was a hard one.
It was a lot. Yeah. That was one of those ones where afterwards I had to go do a palate cleanser.
Yeah. Well, funny you should say that. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But we thought this block was so impactful and so important because murder doesn't just affect the victim and their loved ones. There are people behind the scenes who see day in and day out the destruction that's caused by these monsters. And they often don't get the credit or the respect or the therapy, to be completely honest, that they deserve. And today we have a very special guest, Shannon Bradley Byers. Congratulations on being the first fan turned guest in MU history.
Yay!
All day.
First fan, only fan. It's fine.
This is OnlyFans? I'm in the wrong place.
No. She said you're our only fan.
Oh, okay.
That's afterward.
Oh, that's so, why I have to stay on when we're done, right?
Yes, that's the, we just end the, we end the recording. The Well, I wanted to get into that. So how did you in fact find us? Because you were one of the first real fans to ever just reach out that wasn't part of our like inner circle. And it made us feel so special when you wrote, you told us your story and like, it felt to us like, hey, we reached somebody.
Oh, you did. You did. I was in a subreddit for a podcast I no longer listen to. And somebody I've never figured out who posted a link to y'all's.
I think it was me.
I don't know which one of you it was. I found it like in December and y'all had started in June. So I immediately... I can listen to podcasts while I work. I can't watch them, but I can listen to them. Mm-hmm. So I got caught up, you know, on the 6 months pretty quick. And I was like, you know, with the December that y'all had done was a recap kind of. And I was like, you know, they really need to, I'm a big advocate for what the police and detectives and, you know, first responders, firemen, go through because they're the first person on these scenes. You know, Ed, you do the stories, but you know, the person's long been deceased. You've got no idea what the actual crime scene was like, you know, other than photographs, and photographs do not truly project what was going on at that place and time. And I know from experience that it affects all of us. You know, the morbid humor that we have to deal with or that we devolve into say at a crime scene while we're waiting for somebody to show up because we can't do something until the next person gets there, or, you know, all those things that get really deep inside your brain, your coping mechanisms. And those, you know, yes, the families are by far more affected than anybody. But when you see this day in and day out and have to deal with multiple families on multiple levels, depending on how the person passed away, really wanted y'all to talk to somebody that, you know, had to deal with this stuff on a daily basis, not just like one case that they'd worked over 20 years.
Totally.
But the exposure and what that does to a person. So that was my brilliant idea.
Well, it was a perfect idea, and it's a beautiful friendship that has been formed. So
it has.
But before we dive in too deep, I want to make sure, because there are some audience members who don't know who you are. So the first thing I want to address is that we're going to have in the bottom of the screen an F-bomb counter just for you, because given your mouth of the South and between you and Melissa, I think it's important that we keep track of how many F-bombs, because it could be a new record.
How high can we go?
So for those who don't know you, I want to start by talking about your days at the Gwinnett County Medical Examiner's Office. So tell us about what was your official job title? When did you work there, and kind of what were your duties?
Okay. So basically I was a death investigator for the medical examiner. Georgia is a dual state. We have both medical examiners and coroners, depending on what county it is. Georgia's got 159 counties, and only four of them are medical examiner counties.
So what's the difference, before you get too in the weeds, between a coroner and a medical examiner?
A coroner is an elected official. Their only qualification is a term of residency in the county that they're going to be a coroner for. A lot of coroners are in the funeral industry. They're not actual doctors. A medical examiner is a forensic pathologist. So what happens in Georgia, and I'm not saying this happens in other states, but in Georgia, if you're a coroner county and there is a death that by the Georgia Death Investigation Act has to be brought in for an autopsy, it is sent to that person is sent to the GBI, and the medical examiner at the GBI does the autopsy.
Gotcha.
So coroners don't do autopsies in Georgia, only medical examiners. Gotcha. So Gwinnett County is a medical examiner county. And so I was hired to be the death investigator for our county's medical examiner.
So did you go to school for that? And like, if you didn't, well, either way, what inspired you to do this line of work?
Elizabeth Montgomery's 1975 movie on Lizzie Borden.
Interesting.
Love it.
I was very fortunate to have a mother that did not protect me or shield me. You know, I was reading Stephen King when I was 8. But yeah, the Lizzie Borden movie kicked off both my love of history and true crime.
You and James Cushing, if you recall from last October.
No, because I'm not going to kill anybody.
Well, that, yeah.
But that's part of my interest. So, you know, when I was 7, 8, 9, you know, it was all things historic, all things true crime. My big two were the Pearl Bryan murder from the 1800s in Kentucky, and Lizzie Borden, and then all things Titanic. I mean, that's not true crime, but that kind of, those were my things at the time.
For sure.
I'm fascinated by death. I have always been fascinated by death. You know, what causes it? What happens to your body depending on what was done. So I kind of grew up with that mindset. I mean, the funeral industry would have been okay, but that wouldn't have fed into the knowledge I was seeking, because, you know, once the funeral home gets them, the autopsy's been done, you know, there's nothing other for them to do than to make them look pretty so that the family can see them. Actually, in my previous life, I was a quality director for a metallurgy company.
Oh, wow.
So I was certified to do ISO audits for, you know, laboratories and things like that.
Yeah.
And I was friends with our county's medical examiner. She had done a program for the public, and I had gone to see her, and it was called Sitting Up with the Dead. And I was just fascinated by her. and a friend of mine introduced me to her, and we were talking, and it's like, you know, I'd really love to come work for you. And she's like, you would have to take a severe pay cut from what you're doing now, you know, to be able to come work for me. And I'm like, I do it. And yeah. She's like, well, I don't have room now. Gwinnett County is a little different from the other three counties. The other three counties, the medical examiner's office is actually run by the county. Okay. Gwinnett County contracts the medical examiner's position out to a private pathologist. So I worked for her company. I didn't work for the county itself. In 2017, the company that I was working for, it had gotten bought out by someone whose thing was to buy out companies and then get rid of everybody. So we passed our ISO audit in August of 2017. And 2 days after that, they laid me off. Oh, man. So I texted up, you know, the doctor, and I told her, I says, it won't be a pay cut anymore. When can I start?
Yeah, better than zero.
You know, she took me seriously. Part of it was Gwinnett County had just built a brand new facility. I mean, over $1 million morgue. Wow. For the county. And part of what she also wanted, she wanted another death investigator, but she also wanted somebody that could get the morgue accredited. And because I had my ISO certification, I could do both. Mm-hmm. And her thing was, well, if I hire you as a death investigator, because you haven't had any training in that, I can train you from the ground up, and you don't have any bad habits I've got to get rid of. So that's how I started. And, you know, I went on board in August of 2017, and I worked for 2 years. Wow. Hundreds of cases over those 2 years. Every kind of death you can imagine. In Georgia, there are certain criteria that require you to have an autopsy. If it's a homicide, if it's a motor vehicle accident, if it's a suicide, if it's a drug overdose, if it is a child death, and they consider a child anybody under 17.
Oh, wow.
And if it's what they call an unattended death, depending on the age of the person, that means the person passed away, but they were not under the care of a doctor.
Oh,
there wasn't anybody to sign a death certificate. Like, I'm diabetic, right? So if I died tomorrow because I'm 57, I wouldn't necessarily need to have an autopsy, because I have a medical condition that I am treated for by a doctor that can cause death. So my doctor can sign the death certificate.
Interesting.
If I was not under a doctor's care and was diabetic, I would have to go in and have some level of, there's three levels of autopsy, some level, just so that the medical examiner could sign the death certificate for the funeral home.
Real quick, going back to when you got the job, what did the training entail?
It basically entailed me going to every death scene with the different investigators for 2 months. So 7 days a week for 2 months. So I could learn, you know, because every investigator has their own style. And I think that's, you know, I don't get anxiety over a lot of things, and I don't get scared. But, you know, I was really uncomfortable with the first case I had by myself, because I'm like, I've been immersed with all these different investigators, and they were, you know, they were all guys. I was the only female investigator.
It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, of course, I did learn from them, but there were things that they did that I didn't like. I didn't appreciate some of the ways, you know, the families were handled and stuff like that. So I had to kind of swim through all of that to find my place.
How were the families handled?
Well, it's, you know, one of the things you have to learn, you know, depending on, of course, you know, if it's a homicide, it's a different kind of scene with the family than if it's an older person that was found passed away in their bed. Yeah. Or if it's, you know, the suicide of a teenager in a basement. You know, the family reactions are all different. I've been cussed at, I've been lunged at, I've been smacked because the families were upset. And I had to keep in mind that wasn't them. You know, I'm with them on the worst day of their life. Yeah. And it's not personal. So I had to be able to learn to, you know, not have that gut. You did what? You're not going to like dance on me. You're not going to talk to me that way.
You know what's funny is I've been treated that way too. And I'm like, just a journalist. I could call somebody 4 weeks after a crime, a brutal murder happened, and they will be willing to talk about it, get the story out. I could call someone 25 years after a crime happened and they'll tell me to go f*** myself. Like it's happened both ways.
Well, it's, you know, the people that I was learning from, you know, they were either retired police officers, or had gone to school, you know, for criminal justice. I had no training in any of that. You know, I was somebody, my mother brought me up teaching me everybody's different religions so that I could carry on a conversation with somebody and sound halfway intelligent and understand what the Jewish people did and what the Catholic people did. And, you know, so I kind of brought all that with me. You know, plus being a public speaker, you know, because I have written books, you know, I'm used to talking to people. It's just, I'm really good at being able to walk in and read a room and know what kind of, you know, does this person need a hug? Does this person need me to use my mom voice? You know, being able to do those things and then, you know, not take offense when they're sitting there calling me a whatever, because I won't let them see their loved one. Because but I'm
there's protocol, homicide.
Yeah, and they don't understand that.
Right.
So, you know, I learned really quick. You know, to me, it was really simple things. If I'm sitting in the living room talking to a family, you know, I am not going to stand there and make them look up at me and talk to me. I would sit on the floor. So I was looking up at them, and you know, they were having that conversation because I'm not there as a authority figure, so to speak. I'm there to help them navigate what happens now.
Just saying that, like sitting on the floor like that, shows me that you have empathy. And how important is that in what you did? Because I think the awful news has already sunk in. Like they've registered the trauma, and now it's about now what? And that's where you come in, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends, you know, because most of the time, by the time I got there, you know, the family already knew the person had passed away. Now, there were some instances where I did have to make death notifications, and I will say those made me sick to my stomach. That was very hard to do. I mean, it's just my thing was always, how would I want somebody to treat my grandmother? You know, how would I want somebody to talk to my grandmother if this were the situation?
Great way to look at it.
You know, that's, and also being a female, you know, because there were many, many times I would show up at a scene and they would say, oh, thank God it's you, you know, because so-and-so would not, you know, have been able to handle this transgender person in the bathroom with a needle in their arm.
Right.
You know, they would be making comments on the person, not the situation.
Do you feel like your training adequately prepared you for what you saw?
No.
Yeah, because you've seen some shit, right? I mean,
It's funny. The very first autopsy I ever saw, and I know y'all will laugh at this because I had no clue, right? Even after all the shows I've seen, all the websites I've been on with dead bodies and you know, all the stuff, I walked in, and this person had been a donor of skin. I think they had also done eyes, too, but... they were a skin donor. So they didn't and long bones, right? So their back had been completely flayed. You know, let's think Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs.
I can see it. Oh my God.
Their legs were boneless. So they had these dowels in their legs because they had taken the long bones to get
marrow?
Yeah, marrow. Thank you. So I've got this boneless, skinless guy, right? And they had already done the Y incision, so his front was open too. Do you know what color your fat is?
I would think whitish yellow.
Yeah, you would think white because I mean we all buy steak, we all buy what it's got.
Yeah,
it's the color of a highlighter. It's yellow.
Ooh.
And so he's laying there with his fat layer exposed, and I was just like, I felt so stupid because I did not know human fat was yellow.
You learned real quick.
Yeah, you did. You know, I was also very pleased with, you know, I am not one of those persons that the smells ever bothered.
That was my next question. Because in every show you've ever seen, and I've talked to people who do this, they put that stuff under their nose just to keep the smell.
Okay, let me ask you, what does that do?
I don't know.
That opens it up and gets it all up in there.
You've got methylated decomp. No, I've never understood, you know, it's funny. I would be out with rookies when they graduated police academy and their FTOs would have them with a mask on that had a dryer sheet in it. And they're just sitting in there dry heaving and that thing. I'm like, no, I managed to most of the time get the rookies on their first death scene. And I carried around ground coffee.
Oh.
If you've ever been shopping for perfume, you know yeah.
They
put the little
coffee in there for you to smell in between the perfumes.
Why do I know that? I think that's the question.
Because I'm sure you've been perfume shopping with your wife.
I guess.
But so I would carry around a little container and I would tell the guys, you got to quit coming in and out of the house. Stay in the house or, you know, wherever we were. When we get done, then you can go outside. I will let you smell the coffee and then we'll get that out of your nose. But I'm like, you can't throw up. If you're going to throw up, you got to go outside. And I was always very lucky. For some reason, rancid chicken will make me dry heave. And hairballs from the cat. But decomp, yeah. I never lost it, ever. I mean, I could stay in there as long as I needed to. Never bothered me.
From what I've been told, there's no smell that you can even say, this is what death smells like, because it smells like death. Like there's
there's nothing to compare it to. No, death is death. I mean, I can, now that I know what it smells like, you know, like I can smell a dead animal in the woods or something like that. Or, but before I had been around it, no, I had no idea. My cat didn't like it when I would come home off call because I would smell like that when I walked in the
door. I'll bet. Yeah.
I never thought of that.
Yeah.
How does this line of work affect your relationships? Like, it can't be easy to go see your friends after work. Like, I'll be like, oh, I had such a shitty day. The copier broke and a client yelled at me. Like, I feel like you can't just go out and do that.
Like, they won't understand. They won't get it.
Yeah, like,
I'm very lucky with the circle of friends I have. I won't say they're all as weird as me, but they're close and they get me. But some days I had 22 deaths.
Oh my God.
So some days, you know, maybe only one or two. And, you know, hospice deaths weren't required to be called into us. So we didn't have to handle anything on hospice. But yeah, I mean, you never knew what was going to happen. And once you came off call, you were required to be there for the autopsies for everyone that you brought in. Other counties do it differently. They have techs that do that. But our medical examiner wanted us to be the one taking all the photographs that were going to be used in court or whatever. So it's kind of like a chain of custody for the death investigator. Okay. You know, we handled all the evidence. We are the ones that transported it to the crime lab or the police if they needed it. It was one person that was involved from beginning to end with that person's death.
That's smart, though.
You know, the next morning, you had 24 hours. Maybe you got an hour of sleep. Maybe you were lucky you got three or four. But then you had to do however many autopsies. And then you had to start writing reports because, you know, the police were waiting, you know, on some, if it was homicides or motor vehicle accidents or drug overdoses, you know, they were waiting on things. So you really didn't get a whole lot of time off because even after that, then you're helping the families.
Well, yeah, the deaths don't stop either.
No, I mean, and your phone is ringing constantly because understandably the loved ones didn't remember you were there at the scene. You know, they talked to so many people. There were police, there were firemen, there were, you know, there was me. There was, you know, and now they're having to deal with the funeral home. So you would have follow-up conversations to still help them navigate what they needed to do next, because that was always determined on the kind of death. You know, homicides are completely different than, you know, an older person who just didn't wake up this morning. You know, it's every situation, every death is different.
But how do you, with that amount of death, so I I always think about this in regards to myself, because it's just, you read stories, you see pictures, you watch awful videos all damn day. But then you put yourself in a position like someone like you, who sees it live and sees it as it's happening. Like, how do you even begin to cope with that? And do you, is like therapy included with your job description?
No, I don't know about other places. I can only say for where I was, no. Again, going back to the people I was trained by, they laughed at you if you had a visceral or an emotional response. So I learned pretty quick not to show that at work. I mean, I was kind of known as the ice queen around the county anyway, because I could deal with a family. You know, I could keep it together while I was with the family.
Yeah.
And, you know, my husband was huge support. I mean, I would come home or call him, you know, if I couldn't go home, call him in between calls, let him know what was going on. And he was really the one that was there for me and the rest of my family as well. But I didn't get to see a whole lot of people, because like I say, I was working holidays, working birthdays, working, you know, whatever, because there were only, you know, when I left, there were only four investigators.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm pretty much working every other or every third day. And then when we had weekend call, it was 8 a.m. Friday to 8 a.m. Monday. And then on Monday, you had to do all your autopsies from the weekend. God. So, I mean, my friends knew well, if I said I'm on call, don't even try to get in touch with me, you know, because right. I can't juggle both. And, you know, I was 49, 50, 51 when I was doing that. So it's not like I was some young person needing to have a social life and that kind of thing.
Well, right. But it has to affect the way you interact then when you go home with your family, with your friends, with your husband. Like you had mentioned to me, you definitely have PTSD and you have compassion fatigue. I'd never heard that word. And I mean, I can guess what it means, but what do you mean by that?
It means I didn't give a shit.
Yeah, I believe it.
You know, that's what my therapist told me when I finally, when I found one that specialized in helping first responders who could, you know, deal. You know, this isn't some kind of, oh, I had a tiff with my husband kind of thing. This is, you know, the case that we'll eventually end up talking about that caused my PTSD. I didn't know I had PTSD. I mean, when you get PTSD, there's no light that goes on above your head and says, oh, you have PTSD now. Bang. Yeah. Here's your pillow. You know,
didn't you say it took like a year and a half to even realize it?
For me to realize that had happened.
And when did it click? Like what was the moment?
It was a conversation I was having with a former person, a police officer who had been a detective on the homicide that caused it. I said something to him and he looked at me like I'd grown two heads, because I had completely forgotten he was at the scene.
I had
no memory.
So you were starting to like block stuff out.
Well, I did at that scene. And that's, you know, like one of the number one signs of PTSD is forgetting things. And even going through therapy, I still don't remember. I've come to terms with it. But I've got 30 minutes at that scene. Now, did I block out the really horrible stuff? No. So when I tell you about, you know, that case, you're going to wonder, why didn't you block that out? But I didn't. You know, I knew I had been having some problems. Like I would hear sirens and freeze up. I would wake up in the middle of the night thinking I'd missed a phone call. And this was all after I left, right? Yeah. But this stuff was not necessarily happening while I was still there.
Okay.
So there was a year in between that case and when I left, and then another 6 months before I realized you got a problem. You know, you need to, and I will admit, I mean, this is not a nice thing to admit, but I have always been one of those people that didn't believe in therapy. I was like, you just pull your big girl panties.
Just forget
up.
About it. Yeah, come on. Yeah.
Do what you need to do. I did not believe in therapy at all. You know, I never understood people who went to therapists until
I kind of agree with you. And then eventually it clicks though. And I think it's about finding the right therapist.
Yeah. And what I have learned in the interim is, you know, these days there's two kinds of therapists. There's the therapist who agrees with you and blames everybody else for whatever problem you're having. And, you know, somebody else caused your issue. And there's no accountability. And then you have the kind of therapist I had who, you know, in the first session when I was complaining about some things, he said, you know, what makes you so special that you think you shouldn't have this problem? And I learned, wow. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
This guy's going to help me.
Yeah.
And he has, you know, he has been there for me. He's gotten me through some really tough stuff that I didn't realize until I started talking to him. He has been my savior. So now, you know, yes, yay, therapy, go. You know,
yeah, hooray for therapy. Well, that's an interesting segue because, you know, as well as anybody, this whole month has been about the case that haunts us. So kind of tell us about the one that really rocked you.
Well, it was a baby homicide. Her name was Reagan. She was 2 weeks away from her third birthday. God. And we got a call. I was on call, and I got a call from the dispatcher. We need you out here. This baby that has a medical history, mom found her passed away when she woke up from a nap this afternoon. I did, you know, my normal thing. I got the doctor's information so I could call the child's doctor's office to find out what kind of medical problem she had been born with. To see if it would cause death, you know, anything I needed to know before I went out there. And the doctor assured me, no, that what was wrong with this child should not cause death. She was born without a kidney and a smaller spleen. But that would not cause death. You know, she could live just fine. Like, okay. So the dispatcher had told me that the fireman had said that she looked small for her age. And I was like, okay. So, you know, I get to the house, or it was an apartment, third story apartment. And I do have to preface this. There's some stuff I can't say because it still has not been adjudicated yet. So this is going to kind of be a digest version. I got to the apartment complex. The family was grandmother and aunt were in the parking lot. The mother was sitting outside chain smoking outside the apartment, which was up on the third floor again. I get up there and I walk in the apartment, and the first thing I see is there's an ironing board in the living room. Reagan was on the floor covered up with a pink sheet, which is what our fire department uses to cover people that have passed away. And on the ironing board, she was right under the ironing board, and on the ironing board above her head was a entertainer's license. If you follow my meaning on that.
I do.
Yeah. She worked in a club in another county, and in Georgia, I don't know about there, but you if you dance for other people, you have to have a license.
That's great. I've never heard of that before. I know what you meant, but I've never heard of that being a law. Wow.
So this was right above, you know, Reagan's covered up head. And the rule in Georgia is the death investigator has jurisdiction over the body. The police cannot touch it. They can't search anybody for a wallet. They cannot touch a deceased person. They have to wait till I get there. Now, if the fire department didn't cover them up, they can take all the pictures they want, but they can't move them. They can't search them. They can't do anything until I get there. And that's my job. So Reagan was completely covered up in this, you know, large sheet. So I'm waiting for all the detectives to get there, and I'm kind of looking around the apartment, you know, doing preliminary photographs and stuff. Yeah. And once everybody gets there, I'm standing over her. And there are four detectives there, one on each side of me, right? One in front, one in back, and one on each side. And when I went to uncover her, simultaneously, all four, you know, big gasp, huge intake of breath, and they all turned their backs. And when I looked down, small was an understatement. Any photo you've ever seen of a Holocaust victim did not compare.
God.
So what Reagan looked like, because she was only 14 pounds.
14 pounds.
Her hair was full of feces. What hair she did have. She was all bones. She had been starved to death over her. She had not been fed.
Was it because mom was always out dancing?
There are things I can't say on that. I can say that when the last doctor's visit that was recorded was the November before. This was July of 2018. Mm-hmm. Reagan was 70 pounds in November. And by the following July, she was 14.
I don't think people can comprehend what 14 pounds looks and feels like. Like 14.
It's less than a turkey you cook for a family for Thanksgiving. I mean, you think you get a 20-pound turkey for your family, she was 14 pounds. You would think, you know, it's the horrible stuff that you don't remember. But no, every minute of that is etched into my brain. And what I don't remember is that I kind of lost my shit and was going to be combative with the mother. Luckily for me, she was already down in the parking lot.
You didn't freak out on her, did you? Like go down
on her? No, they wouldn't let me leave the apartment until I calmed down. I don't remember freaking out. And I remember my therapist asked me, he's like, you know, what would you have done if you knew you had done that? And I'm like, I would have quit my job immediately because I would feel I had become ineffective. I had become unprofessional. Now, thankfully, not in the public's eye or anything like that. It was in front of my colleagues. But I would have taken that to heart and I would have quit. And he's like, then that would have been a year of families you didn't help.
That's a great way to look at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, when I looked back on it, like say when I was having this conversation with an officer that was there, I said, you had left homicide by the time of Reagan's case. And he looked at me like I grew two heads. And he says, Shannon, I'm the one who carried her to the car for you.
And I had
completely blocked that he was there. At all. I've got I remember other people being there, but I don't remember him. That's when we realized, there's an issue. And that, like I say, that was 6 months, you know, after I left the position. And that's when I knew I had to find a therapist because those things creep up on you. You know, when you're still dealing with that on a day-to-day basis and, you know, you see the worst that humanity, you know, can do to people. I mean, you see it on the news. I mean, even if you see videos, you know, the dude on the train in North Carolina, the stuff that's going on now, you can see the video of that. But when you're there dealing with the family and, you know, the supposed, you know, person who did that to them is still there because they haven't carted him off to jail yet. You know, you've got to keep it together. You can't. And I think that's what got me is that, you know, I am a mom. So when I saw that poor baby, I was just like, what mother could deliver?
Yes, that's it.
Now, of course, she has been sitting in jail since 2018 and it is a death penalty case.
Okay.
So like that's, you know, why there are certain things I can't say about it yet.
Of course.
But, you know, yeah, she is, you know, it's a death penalty case. I did not realize how that was affecting my performance in my job for another year. I ended up with a case. I mean, it was exactly a year later in July of 2019. And if it's okay, I'll go ahead and go into.
Yeah, do it.
Meeting. Exactly a year later, I had a case of a gentleman who had these medical issues, cirrhosis of the liver. He also had hepatitis C. And I had just had a case 2 weeks prior where it looked like one of the worst homicides. It looked like a horror movie. I mean, there was blood everywhere. And it was something called esophageal varices. It's basically when your insides explode out.
Oh my God.
Through every hole there is. The blood comes out everywhere. And it is caused by a medical condition. So
that's you can horrific.
You have time. Yeah. And I had just had one that looked just like this guy. So I get the call, I go to the guy's house, and I meet with the sister outside. And, you know, she was telling me that she had to go pick him up the day before because he was a, you know, public drunk. And, you know, they said if she didn't come get him, the cops were going to take him in. And, you know, he's a very, very bad alcoholic. And, you know, she was telling me how she had to take care of him all the time and this, that, and the other. And, you know, they had already told me what medications he was taking. So I walked in thinking, you know, he died of a medical condition.
Sure.
You know, they had told me there was a lot of blood there. Unfortunately, because I'd already had a case. I mean, I'd had them before, but I had just had one like this. When I walked in the room, there was blood everywhere. There was blood on the floor. He was laying on the floor with a quilt right around him. Do you know that going in?
This came up last week. Like, how many details do you get ahead of time? Do you just know the basics, or do you know the scope of what you're walking into?
It honestly depended on the scene. You know, there are times I'd be FaceTiming with the cops and they'd be showing me the scene to see if it was something I actually needed to respond to.
Okay.
It also depended on the caliber of the, because when we got the call, we had to call and talk to the responding officer and get all the information from him on what was going on. You know, we had this one case. It was a MVA motor vehicle accident. And the only information I got was that there was a motor vehicle accident on this highway and all the local cops were leaving their part-time jobs because of the description of what had happened to this guy. But nobody told me, right?
Oh, great.
And I always loved MVAs because it was like the interstate or the highway was closed and I got to drive the wrong way on you have to have those little things, you know. I had to walk my car. I didn't have a siren, but I had lights so that they would know, especially at night, that it was the ME's car because our cars were unmarked. Our boss did not want us pulling up to a house in a van that said, you know, going to take away the dead body. I segued. Then I'll go back, I promise.
Yeah, it's a likely story.
I get there and
I trust you. It's a
Kia Soul, right? So it's okay. A small car, right? And all I see is this guy sticking out the back of it, right? This is a total Roadrunner cartoon.
What do you mean sticking out the back?
Yeah. He was a motorcyclist, right?
Yeah.
He had come off his crotch rocket. His head had gone completely through the back window.
Oh, literally stick like legs out. Like,
It had gone through the back window. His head came out between two car seats with kids in them.
Oh my God.
And the rest of him, he had gone in, but he was like this. His feet were like this far from the road. Right.
Oh my God.
And that's what everybody, and the car had folded in around him. So the lady that had been driving the car, she didn't do anything wrong. Right. She had just been driving and he had, it ended up, he had been impaired and he had come off the motorcycle for some reason because the motorcycle kept going for a mile down the road. The woman driving the car was deaf. So she thought when the impact happened, she thought it was the kids in the car seat kicking her seat.
Oh, she's probably swatting.
So she's driving down the highway. Fortunately, this guy died on impact, right? It broke his neck and his spine. So
can you imagine what those kids have to see that? Like this guy comes right through up into him?
Yeah. I mean, anyway.
Talk about so things that live with somebody.
I had no idea what that one was going to look like when I got there. But if we go back to this one, yes. I mean, they had told me there was blood everywhere, but he had these medications, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And like I say, I questioned the sister and she tells me what happened. Tells me that when she brought him home the day before, he had fallen and broken a glass coffee table in the living room. And she had put him to bed and hadn't been able to get him on the phone all day for whatever reason. Even though she was his caretaker, she didn't have a key to the house, so she couldn't get in the next day to check on him. This was her story. And, you know, her whole thing was, you know, thank God I don't have to take care of him anymore. Right. And I was like, okay, you know, I've got all this information. Still haven't been in the house yet. Right. I walk in the house and I walk in the living room and I see there's glass everywhere. And it was like an iron, wrought iron coffee table that had glass panels in it.
Yeah.
The wrought iron was still there, but the glass was all shattered.
Sure, the frame of it, yeah.
So there was glass everywhere. But I remember when I was walking through the house to go to the bedroom thinking, this is one of the cleanest houses I have ever been in, because I have been in the most horrendous quarter. I
cannot even imagine.
Believe it.
I mean, Gwinnett County has got his quarters. And, you know, that smell is worse than a dead body.
Well, yeah, because half the time there's flat cats in there. There's all kinds of stuff. Food. They use the bathroom in a bucket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they've got a path from the bedroom to the, you know, and you're trying to find your way. And in your head, you're thinking,
yeah,
how am I going to get him out of this house? You know? So in this case, I walk in the bedroom and he's laying face down on the floor. You can see where he'd been on the bed with blood on either side of him. You know, it's daytime at this point, but it's still kind of dark in the room. So I've got my flashlight, you know, I'm looking around at the ceiling. There's no blood on the ceiling. He had a night table next to him that had a big white towel on it. And, you know, his medications and a lamp and, you know, there was no signs of a disturbance anywhere in that room, right? No blood spatter on the ceiling or on anything around him. Given his medical history, and what I had just seen on a previous case and the fact that, number one, remember I said he had Hep C, which meant I was full gloved because, you know, I have to, you know, PPE for things I don't want to catch.
Right.
I managed to get the quilt out of his hands, but he was in the height of rigor.
Yeah, explain that.
Okay, rigor mortis usually hits full stage in about 12 hours. And then it's completely gone in another 12. So if you don't find that person until 24 hours after they died, you're never going to see him in the river.
Interesting. So I didn't know it was only a short, I thought it like happened and then it just stayed that way.
No.
Interesting.
And it would depend. I mean, sometimes I would have to break it to be able to examine the person at the scene, you know, to take my photographs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. He was in full rigor. I couldn't break it. Maybe a bigger person than me might have been able to, but I could never break full rigor. I wasn't strong enough to do that.
And it's muscles, right? It's muscles that tense.
Yeah, and the way that he had died, he was like this, right? He had both his arms. Wow. I could not get his arms down. And so I let it go as a natural. I told the sister, call the funeral home. You know, he's got a doctor. We're going to send everything to him. They're going to sign the death certificate, you know, because of the cirrhosis and the Hep C. And I left and I went home. And I got a call about an hour later. They said it was the funeral home transport. And then he's like, Shannon, he's got a hole in his neck. And I'm like,
did your heart sink?
No, honestly. And I'll tell you why in a minute. My brain was, this is where he fell through the coffee table. And I couldn't see it because of his rigor. That in my brain, that's what it said. And they're like, do you think you need to come back out and look at him again? And I'm like, no. I mean, I was on weekend call. This was a Saturday. I'd already had umpteen cases.
Yeah.
And again, you know, hindsight, compassion fatigue, you know, without knowing it. I was like, no. You know, the sister told me everything. He's got, you know, medical history. It looked exactly like that other scene. And I said no. And so the next day, the funeral home decided when they found the hole on the other side of his neck, so he had two, that this looked like homicide. So they called my supervisor, who went out and looked at him, and they determined it was a homicide that I miscalled.
See, and when you screw up in a job like your work, and I say screw up, that is not it. You know what I'm saying?
Oh,
like,
no, I did. I fucked up. Yeah. So I readily admit I fucked up.
But that's the thing. It's not like a regular job where it's a slap on the wrist or it's an infraction or it's a reminder not to do that again. Like you're changing the course of history with the decisions that you make on that scene.
Exactly. And so, and because pressure. I made the wrong call, you know, the first words out of my mouth when they told me were, okay, when I come in, you know, they took me off call for this was on, they let me know on Sunday. I said, when I come in tomorrow, I said, I'll bring all my stuff. I will resign. This is obviously, you know, not good.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, you know, no, we'll talk about it when you come in. I'm like, okay. They didn't actually talk to me about it till the next day because that whole Monday they were doing this gentleman's autopsy. But in the end, they gave me a verbal warning, not even a written warning.
Okay.
They gave me a verbal warning because I had been on the job for 2 years. I mean, I was getting ready to take my certification test. Now, we were getting ready to schedule it. And, but they said, you know, as part of the action for the verbal warning, I was going to have to start going out on death calls all day, every day again, like I did I was originally training.
Which is like adding fuel to the fire.
Yeah, because let's remember, I'm on call for 24 hours every other day or every 3 days, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'm getting no sleep. And it's like I told you, there's a very fine line between explaining what happened and trying to make an excuse. I have never tried to make an excuse for this. You know, I took accountability from day one that I f***ed this up. Mm-hmm. And the sister was crucifying me in the news. I had the news camped out at my house. David, my husband, had to take me out of the state to get me away from the news crews because I was under a gag order because I was still employed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had a permanent gag order on us. We were never allowed to talk to the media on any case that.
So you can't defend yourself.
No, I could not defend myself. I could not say a word. And then, because of the pressure, you know, the medical examiner's office decided to do an interview where they completely lied about everything that they said about me.
Really?
And I couldn't defend myself on that because I'm still working for them, but they're not telling anybody I'm still working for them.
That's tough. Tough set of circumstances. Yeah.
You know, and finally I told them, I was like, you know, I can't, I'm not going to do this. I said, if you want, I will finish out the reports for the cases I still have open. And they were like, well, it's probably better if you don't come to the office, you can do them from home. Mm-hmm. And so I did, you know, for the next 2 weeks, I sat at home and caught up on my cases. But everybody always tried to make it seem like it was a resign or be fired. But that's not what it was. I mean, it was a verbal warning. And I have had people do public record pulls on my employment file with them. The only thing in my employment file is a written copy of the verbal warning and the corrective action. That's all that's in
crazy.
My file. Yeah.
So it was kind of happening behind the scenes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the entire county, you know, all these police, firemen, people at hospitals, chaplains, everybody that I had worked so closely with for 2 years, they were lying on me. And these people didn't know what to think, and I couldn't defend myself. You know, mm-hmm. I would have people reach out to me, you know, Shannon, we know you, we know there's something more to this, you know, and I could tell them behind the scenes, but publicly they couldn't be on my side.
Right. Which is hard.
That broke my heart.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, you know, in hindsight, I can understand because we found out about the PTSD, but at the time I didn't know. I just knew my dream job was gone and I had done it to myself. You know, it was my fault that I had done it. I was never going to be able to help another family again, because that's what I prided myself on, was being there for the families. If they needed, you know, it's like I used to tell them, you're going to have thoughts, you know, if somebody had committed suicide, you know, whether it was an older person or a child or whatever. And I would tell them when I was there at the house, you know, you're going to have thoughts you don't want to say to somebody else. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to be angry. You're going to have things. I am that person. You pick up that phone. I don't care if it's 2 o'clock in the morning. You call me. You can say those things out loud to me, and I will not judge you. And they did for 2 years.
Wow.
And to have that all stripped away.
And all of a sudden, overnight, I don't get to do that anymore. And it's left a huge hole in my heart.
Believe it.
You know, I see stories on the news, you know, with stuff going on in the county. And it's like, you know, man, I wish I could be there for that person. I wish, and I can't, you know, and that's, you know, one of the things that is so hard, you know, when I got this job, I was so excited. Amongst other things, I was like, now I'm going to know what's going on with every news story in the county. Well, did y'all ever, I grew up with my grandmother having that saying, the prayers the devil answered.
Yeah.
Because once I got that job, now I knew exactly how much the news was making up or lying about, because they.
Yeah, you're seeing the inner workings. Back. Wow.
Yeah, because I know what's going on behind the scenes. But you can't, you know, my Facebook page was stalked by my employer to make sure I wasn't saying things
about Texas
that I shouldn't, you know, to the point that she never knew I had a second Facebook account just so I could be me. I mean, I didn't talk about cases, but, you know, because
she does now.
My friends used to give me a hard time because we had a local station around here who, if they found out I was at a homicide scene, they would come out just so they could film me from behind. And they'd even do it from the helicopters so they could get my butt on the
news. That is awful.
It was kind of funny.
I know, but still, it's so shady.
Kind of, because, again, I'm the only female investigator. So, you know, thing was always watching me bend over dead bodies. As my friends would post, you know, maybe saw your butt on the news last night.
And, oh, you're like, that's great.
That kind of that's funny.
But those things that you were talking about that we shouldn't mention, like the little laughter behind the scenes and the things that you say internally with a bunch of guys, I get that. And I think that's why. So we get a lot of shit, as you know, online about our tone and things like that. But
yeah,
I'm so, you have to, like, dealing with the people that are commenting on this don't deal with death day in and day out. And it's like, what you and I do are like apples and green apples. They're not apples and oranges. It's just different ways to experience this death. And I don't think people understand what that does to you.
Well, it's the degree of separation between what you do and what I do.
Absolutely. You know? But the nature of the stuff, I feel like people don't understand that when you deal with it all day long, you have to find an outlet somewhere. And sometimes that comes at, like, we joke about parts of the case, but never about the victim.
Yeah. Do you feel like that's the most, like, misunderstood thing? Like, people be like, oh, that's so cold that you said that. How can you say that? But, like, you have to have some sort of outlet.
Yeah, but they're never going to get that.
No.
I mean, they're never going to understand, you know, things like, okay, let's say smells, right? If we had somebody that died in a fire, right? When a human is killed by fire, it smells like barbecue. That is what it smells like. So, you know, you've got jokes about what are we going to have for lunch today? Or,
it's,
you
not
know,
barbecue, yeah.
You know, stuff like that. And, you know, everybody copes with things differently. I mean, I always tell people when somebody, it's got to be somebody extra, extra special for me to have an actual reaction to their death. You know, and I've really only had a couple of those in my life. And it's not being cold-hearted.
No,
it's just, you know, that's the way I've always been. I have always been somebody that understood, to me, death is not final. Final for your physical form, but to me, it's not final. And I'm not saying that in a religious way. I mean, anybody can take that the way they want, because everybody has their own beliefs on what happens when you die. You know, my interest was just always what happens to your body when you die. I know what happens to the rest of you. But it's not the death that ever bothered me. It's the reason for the death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what a human can do to another human. And that's what I had to learn to wrap my head around. you know, with somebody purposely deciding to take somebody's life or take their own life.
And so viciously.
Suicides are not easy, you know, especially when they're kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know if Pennsylvania is the same, but in Georgia, they don't report suicides in the news unless it's something like a murder-suicide, you know, if it's a domestic.
Yeah, you don't hear much about it. I don't know if there's a rule, but there you don't hear much.
We would have a suicide every other day. Wow. I mean, there's very high suicide rate in this county. So I was seeing that day in and day out. And, you know, people always say, you know, well, they need to publish the note the person left. In all the suicide cases I had in the 2 years that I was there, and we're talking, you know, almost 1,000 cases I had in 2 years, I had 3 suicide notes.
Wow.
Yeah, they don't
exist. People do not leave a suicide note. Yeah. I mean, it's not as common as people think. Yeah. And if they do, sometimes they're not very nice, you know, and the family doesn't need to see them, but we have to give them to them.
Well, yeah, when you're at your wit's end, I assume the words that come out of your mouth are not happy.
Well, I mean, it depends on how you think about it. A lot of people, and you know, this is something I always used to say too, people who threaten suicide normally don't carry through on it. They're looking for attention. Now, I'm not going to say that's 100% the time, but it's the suicides of the people that, you know, they've thought this out, they've planned it, they've, you know, it's not a spur of the moment thing, and they were the happiest they've ever been the couple of days before they killed themselves. And people are like, no, somebody did this to them because they would not have killed themselves, which is the story that I did for the Tell Me How I Died TV show. That was how the case was based, because nobody would believe that he committed suicide.
Right.
Everybody thought it was a homicide. So, okay. You know, because people don't leave suicide notes, at least not in Georgia. I mean, I don't know if that's a George thing, but.
And mental health is such a hot topic now. But I mean, people like Robin Williams, you see this facade that they've been taught to put on or that they've had success putting on. You don't know what's going on behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. They're all smiles and joking.
You
know. And it's
tragic. I mean, you never know. And it's the person's personality, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just, as far as the case that I f***ed up, you know, I just want to leave it with, you know, I do take responsibility. I never said, oh, well, you know, I couldn't do this or I couldn't do, you know.
Right.
No, I always said that this is on me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they didn't even want to take my job for it, even though they tried to tell the news they were. So, you know, my message is don't believe everything you see on a news report. Don't believe every newspaper article you read, because journalists, unfortunately, I have learned they just want a story and they're going to do, you know, whatever it takes. And I saw that to an extent, you know, online when I was having to keep my mouth shut, especially like the case that I did for A&E. Mm-hmm. I couldn't say a word about what was going on with that.
But let's talk about that A&E show, because it had to be interesting going back to work on that case, because that was just last year, right?
Well, it aired September a year ago.
Okay. So tell me about the, I'm more interested personally in your experience with the show the television show, but I mean,
it wasn't horrible. We had a case in August of 2018. It was actually a couple of weeks after Reagan's case, where, they had a dead body in a lake. And I happened to be on call when the person saw him floating and called it in. And we had a missing person in the area for a couple of days. And we had been taking bets at work on who was going to be on call when they found him. Right. And it turned out to be me. And as I kind of mentioned before, they had thought it was going to be a homicide, but it was a suicide because he had tried to make it look like homicide. He had taken all these great lengths. So we'll fast forward to last year was 2024. So spring of 2023, A&E contacted me about a new show. They were filming some episodes for us called Tell Me How I Died. And they were going to feature this particular case and wanted to know, if
that's how it goes. Cold call.
You know, would be willing to do the show. And, you know, I explained to them, I was like, you've got to understand the circumstances under which, you know, I left this field. And if you're willing to have me on the show, I am more than happy to do it. You know,
good for you.
Yes. And, you know, they had no issues with that. They had already pulled my employment record and knew that that was the only thing in there. Mm-hmm. They had done all the background work on me before they even called me.
We have to actually do full background checks because television shows don't like to put forward someone who has a criminal history because right. They want to be promoting criminals.
Never having done anything like that, I it didn't even occur to me they would have checked me out first. Yeah. But they did. And so I went out and I filmed, and, you know, I was super nervous about that because it was a TV thing, you know.
Sure.
Yeah, I've got visions of Dateline in my head, you know. I want Keith sitting in front of me questioning
Morrison.
Me, because that's my guy.
He's
yes, I'm a huge
you and your Morrison. You and Melissa with your old person fetishes. I can't.
Love them.
I am not going to apologize at all. So when I got out there, it was all those were dashed, right? We met at an old mill, and they had rented it for the day, and they're going to have me and a couple of other policemen that had been on there. But we were all interviewed separately, and it wasn't an interview per se. They put the camera on me. I'm sitting there, and the girl was like, I'm going to tell you what I want you to talk about. I want you to explain this part to me and make sure you use complete sentences because I'm not asking you questions. We never heard anybody else on camera. And that was kind of hard to wrap my head around.
See, now I walked in ask any of the guests that that have been on a Cold Case Files that I've produced. There's a technique to it. And like, the key is to just stop you. Like, it's not being rude. Like, if you start saying it the wrong way, you just say, actually start it like this. Like, I feed the participants the way to start the sentence. Like, if I ask you, what color shirt are you wearing? If you just said blue, the audience, when there's no narrator, is going to have right. No idea what you're talking about. So you need to just answer in a complete thought. It's a tricky way to talk.
And it is. But for me being a writer, it wasn't, I just had to change the way because I had gone in thinking it was going to be a back and forth interview. Mm-hmm. The audience was going to hear the question and then camera was going to pan to me.
Like a news interview. Yeah.
You know,
like Dateline. Yeah.
So, you know, when I realized I was basically going to be telling the story, and I don't know if y'all both or either have actually watched the episode, but I think I did a
You did great. And the magic of television, like, even if you didn't, they'll take the good parts and make it look like you did.
Well, what made me so mad, they filmed me for over 3 hours. I talked for 3 hours straight, and I was on there for like 7 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was so much that they left out that didn't, I guess in the end, it didn't fit the narrative for what the ending that they had put up, because, you know, they tried to make it look like, you know, he had killed himself because he was gay. You know, they left that unworded, but that's the assumption they left you with.
Yeah. They would never say that. They would.
Some of the things I talked about, like, you know, what the public had put not only the family through, but us at the medical examiner's office, because like I say, they wanted our heads because we said he killed himself. I was really disappointed in that part of it, but the rest of it, I absolutely loved it. I was like, if you want to do another one, here's some more cases. You might, you know, call me.
I just filmed an episode of a show that I cannot mention yet, but we interviewed 11 people for this one episode. And like, each person we spent a half a day with easy, and like, they're going to get on there and have two sound bites. I mean, it's just the way it is, because you only have, unfortunately, with television, you're limited to that time length.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I will say I got more. I figured I'd have 30 seconds.
Yeah. 8 minutes is pretty good.
So, yeah, when we timed it, I think it was 7 minutes. And they let me be the one to announce that it was a homicide. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it was a suicide, not
a
homicide.
Pretty cool.
I got the big part, per se, in it. So, you know, it didn't put me off to where I would never do it again, you know, mm-hmm. if somebody wanted me to do it. I mean, yeah. I would like Keith Morrison, but
I'm sure you would.
Yeah. Or Edge. Yeah. Now I know Edge. Can I have Edge?
Yeah. I'll tell you what, that's the one thing, and we talked about earlier in the interview, like being rednecks. Well, I'm a redneck. I mean, just because I'm in Pennsylvania, like I think that's the reason that I have such a way with people. And I think that's the only thing that makes me a good producer. Like, I'm not the best writer. I'm not the best storyteller, but people don't want to see people come down from New York and LA, all these hot shit producers. When they see a guy show up in a baseball cap and a t-shirt, it feels like you're talking to a human being, and I feel like they get their story out a little easier when they feel comfortable around you. And that's my job, make it feel comfortable. And I think that's one of my strong suits.
Having seen your end result, since we don't get to actually see you on camera, I will agree.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
I'd rather see you on camera talking to somebody, but that's because I've gotten to know you, for the last 10 months. So, I, for one, really appreciate your take on the victim as the one that's important.
We appreciate that. Melissa and I made us strong. That's the most important thing.
Yeah. And it's, so many, I'm going to get on my soapbox for a second, but so many other podcasts just want to go on and on and on and on and on about the perp. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I do think you need to know things about the perp, but I don't think we need the family tree on the perpetrator.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't think you need that much focus. And
I think it's important to understand where he came from and what might have led to him doing what he did, just to learn a little bit about how this guy's wired. But yeah, other than that.
But no, I mean, and that's one reason I love Murder Unscripted so much. And what I told you, when I first contacted y'all is that, it is the victim for you. And to me, that, the victim in what I did, it was the victim's family. I've got Facebook friends that were family of people that I helped. And, Reagan's family, we exchange cards, we exchange emails. And again, we can't talk, I think, as openly as we'd like to, since she's still sitting in jail. But yeah, I've got, several friends, that I'm very close to now that were family victims of victims. Because they did remember everything I did for them.
And that's got to go. That's got to go a long way in your mind.
It does. Those days when I'm having a really hard time where, I'm down and I'm like, I'm never going to be able to do that again. Mm-hmm. Inevitably one of them will reach out. It's like they kind of knew I was having a hard time or something. And, they'll reach out and say something about, I just want you to know how much I still appreciate everything you did. And there were a few funerals that I went to, which is kind of odd because most death investigators don't go to funerals, but like with Reagan, the only visual I had of that child was when I uncovered her, because the mother didn't have any pictures in the house, no pictures on the phone of her. That was all I had in my head. So I got permission to go to the funeral and, to try to help because I was having a really hard time. So David went to the funeral with me, and, they had all these pictures of her, and she was fat and sassy and, bouncing along and singing and just being a 2-year-old that could replace the only image I had of her in my head. And, that went a long way at the time in stopping the nightmares. They eventually came back, but at the time, when it's like the first time you see a picture of a Holocaust victim, and the famous ones I'm talking about,
of
the men, the alive people, when they were liberated. If you saw a picture of them a year later, a year before, you wouldn't recognize them.
Of course.
And that one photo is all you've got in your head. And that's all I had with Reagan.
When you think about her to this day, now that you've seen those good images, do you picture those? Or I know you're never going to forget what you saw that day. But
yes. Yeah. It, for the most part, it's replaced it. Now, if I'm actually talking about the case with somebody, I revert back to.
You have to put yourself in that moment.
Yeah. And, because that will be burned in my brain forever. Right. You know, you also have to consider I had to help do the autopsy on her as well.
Right.
So it wasn't just, you know, being there with her, taking pictures and that kind of thing. It was, you know, I had to do her autopsy. I had to help clean the feces out of her hair and wipe the urine off of her because allegedly she had been locked in a closet while she was unattended at home.
Why become a mom? Melissa and I have this discussion almost once a month. Why become a mom if that's how you're going to treat your kid?
Well, and that wasn't her first child.
Reassuring.
You know, the family got so upset with me because I would not let them see her at the scene. And it was one of these, you know, I got cussed out. And I'm just like in my head, like, no, you don't want to. And I was like, you know, until we, you know, you can see her at the funeral home. That was always our stock answer. You can see them at the funeral home. They were mean to me. But when I went to the funeral, they found out I was there. Dave and I were the only white people at the funeral.
No kidding.
And, And so we kind of stood out.
Yeah.
And when the grandmother who had given, and the sister, the aunt, that had given me such a hard time found out I was there, you know, they came and talked to me, and they invited Dave and I to, you know, the meal afterwards that they were having in the fellowship hall. And I was like, no, we don't want to intrude. And she's like, no, we really want you to come. And I was like, okay, I'll go grab a drink or something. And, you know, eventually she came over and apologized and told me that when she did see Reagan at the funeral home, she understood why I had been the way I was. And everybody that I did that to, you know, in the end did.
Well, I feel like the dust settles and level heads prevail to an extent.
Well, you know, there may have been more than one homicide that day if I'd let the grandmother see that poor child. I don't know. I mean, you know what I mean. You know, I'm not saying she would have done that, but... Right. There would have been those thoughts. But no, you know, since I got to see those pictures, you know, when I think of her, when I communicate with her grandmother, you know, that's who I think of, is that fat little sassy.
Good.
You know, because she was almost, she was 2 weeks away from being three. So she was two in the pictures that I saw.
So sad.
And to hear her voice, you know, I can... In the videos that they played of her singing and dancing.
Brings her to life. Shows her she's a person, not this thing.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's going to be because, you know, I am still eligible to be called, and I am sometimes, on my homicide cases. I mean, just because I don't work there anymore doesn't mean I don't have to go testify in court. Right. And with this being a death penalty case, I fully expect that they're going to want me to. But, you know, I'm going to have to make sure that the DA understands I've lost time at that scene. And any good defense attorney is going to say I'm not reliable because I don't have total recall.
And there's some truth to that.
I don't want to mess that case up.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I mean, I will do everything I can to get out of having to testify.
I was going to say maybe not testifying would be the best way to get justice.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They're going to have to understand that, you know, it's in my medical record that I've got PTSD now.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about your interest in like the historical side of true crime, because like at your core, you're a researcher, a historian. So where did that love come from? I mean, we kind of talked about the Elizabeth Montgomery and
Lizzie Borden. Yes. Mm-hmm. The Lizzie Borden case, because, you know, when I saw that movie, you know, my mother will tell you I was reading in the womb. You know, I've always been a book reader. And, you know, she really encouraged that every summer. You know, how many books can you read between the time school's out and the time school goes back in? And our vacations growing up, my parents always took us somewhere historical. You know, whether it was Fort Frederica, you know, in the Battle of the Bloody Marsh down in St. Simons or up to Williamsburg or some Confederate battlefield. Our vacations were always educational. They were fun, but, you know, that history seed just got planted really, really early. And when I was 13, I had to do a project for school. They wanted us to take some story that had been passed down in the family and, you know, write a paper on it and then do a family tree on the people in that story. Well, the story I happened to pick was one that decades later would become known as Cold Mountain.
Oh, wow.
That's interesting.
The character that Jude Law played was my third great uncle.
Shut up.
And my cousin, wow. Charles Smith. Charles is the one who wrote the book. And, but I started with that story, you know, when I was 13, way before any of that stuff happened. And I spent the next 30 years tracking down the true story, which I have written about, in my book, the difference between the movie and what really happened. Right. Because, you know, I had an uncle that used to say, you know, every bit of anything that's true in the Cold Mountain movie would fit on the back of a postcard. Mm. And basically it was, you know,
based on a true story.
Have y'all both seen the movie?
Yeah.
Or read the book?
Yeah.
I saw the movie.
Okay. All right.
I saw the movie.
So Nicole Kidman didn't exist in real life. Spoiler for people.
Oh.
You may want to fix that. I don't.
kind of important.
But yeah, she, you know, but Jude Law's character did. But it, none of the stuff that happened, you know, they built the church, but it was the 1900s when that church was built, not during the Civil War.
Not the Civil War. Interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, I wasn't running around with a tray of root beer, you know, enticing, you know, Inman to come see her at the house and, Rudy
you don't
was
say.
Throwing chickens
yeah.
under the porch. And now I will say, because I love Renee Zellweger, she did such a good job portraying a North Carolina mountain woman.
A lot of these actors will research and like go down there and spend time there just to get a feel for the town. And
I'm not scared of people, but when Dave and I go up to North Carolina, I don't like going in the gas stations up where that actually happened because those women are mean. yeah, I've got a lot of that DNA in me, but they're hard mountain folk. I mean, they're all moonshiners. Yeah. So, you know, but yeah, that's what got me into loving history and genealogy. So I combine the two.
Amazing.
And, you know, Ed can tell you that, you know, I'll get some kind of little, what was that case of that woman with the, all the dead babies in her attic?
It
took me like what, 20 minutes?
Yeah. What was
you
that?
You were in the She's hospital amazing. At the time. So you didn't realize it only took me 20 minutes to find
it. That was amazing. So Melissa, I don't even know if you knew that, but Shannon sent me this story and it was just an old archive story about this crazy woman who was storing bodies in the attic. And I was enthralled because we were like dissecting it a little bit.
Yeah.
One random article.
And I was like, I found this. And then, you know, he quit talking and I'm like, where did he go?
I think
and
I was dying at that point.
Yes, you know, but you know, I didn't know until later you were in the hospital.
I didn't want to tell anybody.
But you'll have some stories that y'all do that y'all don't give me the information I want. You didn't dig deep enough for me. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting here like, you know, Melissa didn't tell me this. I got to go find out this. Or Ed didn't tell me this. Or I really
need I'm to sorry.
Know. So.
Well, let me defend myself on that. If Ed let me, I would have these episodes be 17 hours long. But someone here puts a time limit on me.
That's what I was telling him yesterday. I was like, this needed to be your first two-parter interview because, you know, I could talk all night long.
I know.
It says all the people who don't edit these things. So, yeah, go ahead. Just okay. 3 hours.
And what else can I tell you? Don't edit it. Just play it.
I'm going to play it, but I got to put pictures up, so I'm going to have to ask you for pictures, too. You're going to have a lot of pictures you need to cover.
Get
going through the archives.
Hey, well, I got pictures.
Good. Well, I'm going to need them.
Never about pictures.
Good. Well, this was an awesome interview. And before you go, that history little tidbit is going to wonderful segue into the final segment before you leave us. So I believe I told you that we were introducing a new segment on this show. And what better guinea pig, I felt like, than Shannon Byers. But that's honestly only a half truth because it's not really new. But backed by popular demand. And we can thank one of our listeners in the UK who wrote in, who demanded we bring back the palate cleansers. So we used to do them at the end of each block, and I would try to stump Melissa. But now, instead of stumping Melissa, the competitor is going to be our guests. So we are going to introduce a segment where all of our guests play a little game with us. So if you actually listened to that episode we did a couple months back with the wonderful ladies of People Are the Worst, you'll be familiar with the game, Two Lies and a Crime. Mm-hmm. Well, so
I thought that was really cool. I thought that should be a podcast on itself.
Well, lucky you, because since you have this love of old timey folklore, we're going to be playing a game, the historical version of Two Lies and a Crime, which is entitled Two Myths, Truths, and a Two Mistruths and a Dastardly Deed.
Failed this miserably.
Which is how I assume everybody talked back then.
My goal is to have the lowest score possible.
All right.
You got this. All right, so Ed and I are going to be presenting you with three historical case like synopsises, and one of them is real, and the other two were created with the help of our good friend ChatGPT. And you have to tell us which is the real crime. And if you do, you win a super sweet Murder Unscripted sticker pack.
Whoa.
Hey, man. Wait a minute. I thought I got a sticker pack just for being here.
Shut up. Don't tell
you
people that.
You do, but don't tell anybody.
I guess I'm supposed to know that.
And can I just say there were no recesses in the green room while I was sitting here having
those things? You're lucky we have any kind of room. You know what these things cost? You know what this service costs a year? I don't even want to talk about it. Heartbreaking. Talk about things that haunt us.
Yeah, that would be those Charles Stanley ads that haunt me.
Yeah, and Chumba Casino.
The casino I don't mind, but you know, having Charles Stanley thrown at me while I'm trying to take a shower on Tuesday mornings is kind of weird.
I've been getting Botox ads.
That's a sign.
I know, you know? I'm feeling attacked a little bit, but it's fine.
Well, Shannon Byers, are you ready to play two mistruths and a dastardly deed?
Can I get them wrong on purpose?
You can do whatever you want. Okay. I don't care how you play. You're going to get the stickers anyway. All right, here we go. Case number one. In London, 1897, 42-year-old Edmund Clark collapsed outside a known prostitution house after what witnesses described as a sudden jab from another man's umbrella. Doctors discovered a small puncture wound suggesting the umbrella had been modified to deliver poison through a hollow shaft. Though sensationalized by the press as an act of gentleman assassin, no suspect was ever brought to trial. That is case number one.
All right, case number two. In Chicago in 1911, 28-year-old Martha Dwyer was discovered bludgeoned in the kitchen of her boarding house. Detectives concluded the weapon was a frozen leg of lamb pulled from the icebox, which the killer had attempted to cook afterward in an attempt to erase the evidence. By the time police arrived, the meat had half thawed, leaving only a slimy goo behind.
Mm. Are you making any assumptions already in your head?
No, I'm waiting for number three.
Interesting. Okay, well, here it is. In St. Louis, Missouri, 1897, 20-year-old Gussie Park was found dead in a downtown boarding house. He had been stabbed repeatedly in the ear with a sharpened pencil, a peculiar and unsettling weapon. Witnesses recalled hearing a heated argument just before her death, but the killer had fled before police arrived. So those are your three cases, and you need to tell us, you're not even messing around. I'm sorry, that's not correct. It is case number three, Gussie Park.
I like murder by leg of lamb. That's
pretty good.
I like that one too.
That was pretty good. There has to be a mutton joke in here somewhere, like a
somewhere.
Mutton.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so
the third one was real.
No. It was Gussie Park. So after a short investigation, police identified Gussie's attacker as William Willie Kaiser, who was quickly arrested and later convicted. The use of the pencil was so unusual that it dominated newspaper headlines at the time, turning the case into one of the strangest murders of the late 19th century.
Sounds awful.
There you have it.
It's all weird.
It's all weird. Would you rather get hit by a leg of lamb?
That's what threw me off, because to me, a pencil wouldn't be weird. You die of lead poisoning, just like...
You know. You don't get lead poisoning. You die of that stabbing by a pencil. Jeez. So, Shannon, where can people find us? You do our outro.
Please check out their socials. First, we have Reddit. that I'm very hard on. And, you know, I was telling Ed last night, the show with the interview with Rob Bettner.
Yep.
How you say it? We got 600 Reddit views when I posted it on there. So right. y'all are failing. I have worked so hard on keeping. I'm over there talking to myself, making comments, trying to get people engaged. So
I know. So what do we have to do?
Okay, so most of the time, y'all are remembering to mention it when you, you know, do Facebook or your website or, you know, but you're not putting it in the post on Facebook.
It's because 10 people see it. It's the same 10 people that see it every week. It's
well, still.
Yeah. Still. Yeah.
You know, put it before all the keywords.
Oh, okay.
Put the link before all the keywords. And one of y'all could actually, you know, comment so that they you know, let's interact with it, or let's interact with Melissa, not just the paranormal genealogist who's making all these posts, you know, because you go on there and look, every single post is by me.
I know. I look today, I'm like, oh, we got to do something about this.
Yeah, you know, right, and I update it faithfully, so you know.
I know you do, and I appreciate that, seriously.
Yes, thank you.
It's not doom scrolling all the politic crap on Facebook. You know, If people, you know, want to see how cute Rob Bittner is, you know, they can just type his name in the search bar and Reddit, and murder and scripting comes up, and they can look at all the other cases and you know, learn about the people we don't like and talk about anymore, and you know who our new people are and how great Keith Morrison is. And
I just want one person to comment and be like, you know what, I don't really like the show, but Ed is so handsome that I just watch every single
thing. Make your wife mad.
Exactly.
I just want her to see that other people think I'm handsome too. See what you'll be missing.
Okay, you are handsome. You are a very nice-looking gentleman, but I don't want your wife mad at you.
I don't count. You're biased.
I don't count. Okay, all right.
I want to rant.
Oh, Ed, you're so hot.
It's not, you're going to be sleeping out in the treehouse. I just said you don't count. Amazing. Thank you so, so much, seriously, for not only being our guest today, but also all the help you've provided along the way and all the support. I mean, seriously, yes. Like just having you in our corner, somebody that's outside our inner circle, it just feels like it's finally, I don't know, you were a special, that was a special email that came in when you sent it to us. We really appreciated that. And it's led to this. So thank you. Yeah, there's that. So we will chat very soon.
Yes. All right. So, no, thank you for having me, and, you know, just keep doing what you're doing, and, you know, it's reaching the right people. Just believe that it is reaching the right people.
Melissa, I didn't tell you. Shannon said that to me. Yesterday was a little rough for me, and she said something to the effect of like, I was complaining about how like the last mini got 4 views. I'm like, we spent hours on these things for like how many, you know? And she was just like, yeah, but if one person hears this and it helps them in some kind of way, that's really what it's about. And you're absolutely right. And sometimes I forget that.
Well, and it's not always about views. You've got to remember, you're on all the platforms. It's like that. I can't watch the YouTubes. I have to do it where it's audio because I do it in the shower I can make sure I'm done so I can get the Reddit post up when I get to work. And so, you know, it's sometimes a week before I even hop over to YouTube. So you don't know who it's reaching. Just because it's not a YouTube click or a view on Facebook doesn't mean somebody didn't hear it somewhere.
Very true.
Well, thank you you're omnipresent.
We're trying.
You know, Charles Stanton believes in you, and so do I.
Yeah, perfect. All right, Shannon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. I didn't necessarily think I was going to learn what a dead body smelled like today, but here we are.
Yeah. I've always wondered, but I don't really want to know. Like, I don't really want to smell it to know, but I have always wondered.
Well, yeah. I mean, you picture passing a deer carcass on the road or something like that. I feel like we're all animals and we all smell the same when we die. I have a feeling.
Probably. Yeah.
Well, that was super interesting and very insightful, because some of the mechanics about how MEs work and how coroner's offices work and how, like, it's just, it, you don't get to hear that kind of perspective too often. So that was very awesome of her to come on and share that stuff, even some of the more traumatizing stuff that she went through.
Well, and I like that we got to talk to someone who you don't generally think about, because there's not really shows about death investigators. Like, you see Law and Order SVU, you see what the detectives do, you see, you know, crime scene tech stuff, but like, you don't get to see that aspect of it. So I thought that was really interesting.
I agree. And it really shows how this does affect, I think that really puts a punctuation mark on this block very nicely, mm-hmm. because this is someone who works in the industry and sees death constantly, not so much anymore, but when she did, I mean, it changed her, I think.
God, and those hours, I can't even imagine.
You can't work 9 to 2.
That's too long for me. Yeah.
You text me sometimes at 9:40. You're like, just getting to work. I'm like, what
time zone are you in? I don't be yeah, listening. It's fine.
Oh my gosh, Melissa, what do we have next month? We don't have our name picked out for next month, our block theme name.
No, we don't, but it's spooky.
It is. But people should understand that it's not like traditional spooky. Like, so many podcasts are doing like the Halloween murders that haunted me. Like, it's the Halloween murders. Yeah, it's way cooler.
And our guest is way cool too.
Yeah, she's big. It's a she. That's what we'll give you. That's your clue. It's a she, and she's big. Again, not physically in stature.
She's little in stature, but she's big in true crime.
Big in notoriety, yeah.
Yes.
All right, cool. So until then, let us know, guys, what you thought about Shannon's interview. If you have any follow-up questions for her, Shannon is one of the most engaged listeners we have. So, I mean, if you have any questions for her, you can ask her directly, and you can find us on our socials, which are where?
You can hit us up on our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com. You can email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us on Facebook, Insta, TikTok, Blue Sky, and Reddit. Hell yep. Yeah. Hit us up on Reddit. We are at Murder Unscripted.
That is it for us, you guys. We will be back next week with a brand new block of spooky to be named block cases.
But until then, stay safe, stay hydrated, and remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
Shannon's a pervert. She just doesn't want you to know it.
That's seriously like the main reason we love her.
It's true. Among other reasons. That's a good one. See you guys.
Bye.